Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to, an interesting fellow. I guess I'll call him a statistician at the moment, but you'll hear that he's got a very interesting background, how he came to that. His name is Armin Schwartzman, and he's from the University of California in San Diego in the Department of Biostatistics. And to keep him honest, I've got next to me my good friend Russell Chianelli from Science Studio from time to time. And here we go. So, Armin, welcome to Science Studio.
Yes, welcome, Armin.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to hearing your story. So before we get into exactly what you do, and I know that that's going to involve getting into bio aspects and also climate change, start out with how you became what you are today. Where did you start your life? How did you begin your education? And why on earth become a statistician?
Well, it's a long story. I grew up in Lima, Peru, in a third world country. My father was an engineer, and I wanted to go forward, and I always wanted to be at the forefront of technology, and therefore I decided to become an electrical engineer. And I started out there, and then I transferred to the Technion in Israel, where I studied electrical engineering.
That's in Haifa.
In Haifa, that's right. And even went on to get a master's at Caltech, also in electrical engineering. And so I was an engineer, and I got my first job at Rockwell Semiconductor in San Diego, actually, in California, doing modem design for satellite communications. And so I was always an engineer, at least at that point. But that is the moment where my first breakpoint happened, when I realized that I was spending all this time, so many hours in front of a computer doing programming, developing this super smart technology. And I was there at the forefront of technology, right? Really. And then I realized that all that was hidden, and really nobody outside that group really cared about what was happening, right? At the end of the day, that was just technology that was going to be sold so that some people could sit on their couch and watch TV, basically, and just being sold to customers. And I couldn't do that. I had a really difficult time with that. I wanted meaning. I wanted meaning in what I do.
A different type of meaning. I mean, that has meaning.
Oh, yes, I mean, of course. I very much enjoy the details.
LED screen TVs bring a lot of satisfaction and happiness to a lot of people. It's just that you didn't think that was where you wanted to use your talent.
Just a more direct impact, perhaps. Right. And at that time, thanks to my to-be father-in-law, who was a physician, then I developed some interest in medicine, and I went on to work on biomedical technology, basically. And there, for the first time,
As an engineer, yes.
But there I encountered measurements from the heart, measured by electrodes.
Other people's hearts.
Right,
people's hearts. This wasn't something your heart was involved in. It was just you were doing statistics on information from cardiac patients.
Exactly. And my task was to separate the signals that came from healthy tissue from the signals that came from unhealthy tissue, and that would help, therefore, the machine map out where the damage to the heart had happened when, for example, a person had a heart attack. So that had direct impact on patients, so I really liked that problem. But then I discovered that all the knowledge that I knew from signal processing was useless because there was so much variability in biological tissues. And I started researching this, and a colleague of mine who worked there, who was from computer science, introduced me to principal components analysis. And through there, I started discovering that what I needed in order to solve this problem was statistics. It was such an eye-opening experience.
The sun came out.
But particularly because I had completely hated statistics up to that point. And this is a typical complaint that I hear, right? Every time I meet people and I tell them that I do statistics, and they say, oh, I hated statistics when I took it. And I understand actually why they do, because that was my experience as well.
It sounds like the average 11-year-old boy hates girls, but 6 years later, my goodness, the sun has come out.
So that's a different topic that we could talk about, which is how statistics is not taught correctly. And it's just given us a mandatory course that people need to study. And that was my experience too, up to that point, right? So it's only when I had real data and I had a real problem that I had to solve that I became fascinated by all these tools and the possibility to model things and to quantify uncertainty and develop algorithms that actually can separate these tissues. And so that's one reason. That's one way I discovered it.
So you were working for a company at this stage or just...
Yes, I was working at a company.
Right.
Yes, and of course everybody there could not believe when I told them that I was going to quit working for the company to go do a PhD and reduce my salary to about 20% of what it was.
Yeah, well...
So go back to, you said that your father was an engineer as well?
That's right.
So could you tell our listeners a little bit about how that influenced your decision when you were younger, much younger, to become an engineer? Why did you become an engineer?
I had a scientific mind just like my father's, for one thing. And he used to take me to this textile factory where he worked and show me the machines.
In Lima?
In Lima, yes. Textile industry is big and is big there. I was just fascinated by all these machines and how these things work. And I used to help my dad around the house fixing things, right? So I developed just an interest for doing that, for learning how things work.
So when you quit your job, right, you say the people in the company said, "Why, are you crazy? You're going back to graduate school and giving up all this great salary and high-tech material." What did your father say at the time?
He always supported me.
Do what you want to do. It's up to you. That's what he said. Do what you want to do. It's up to you. You have freedom to do it any way you want.
Yes, yes. My parents always supported me with my career choices. The only, I guess, unfortunate thing that happened is that while I was an engineer, I could talk to my father more about the details of what I did for work. And once I became a statistician, then the communication lessened. But it doesn't matter. I think the way I see the transition is that while before I was fascinated, wanted to learn about how machines work and how technology worked, then that interest simply shifted into trying to learn how the world works.
And that seemed a better application of your skills.
So seeing the world and seeing nature as this huge, complicated machine that also has rules and mechanisms, and I'm still fascinated by it or trying to understand how the world works around it.
So let's move on to what you're doing right now, Armin. What are your passions right now, this application of your expertise in biostatistics and statistics in general?
Many things.
Aha.
Many things. I really work on...
Have statistics will travel, sort of intellectual gypsy from one topic to another.
Well, precisely one reason why I liked statistics as a field is because it applies to so many different areas. And at that point, when I had decided to go back to academia and pursue a PhD, I also had to do some thinking in terms of in which area I would like to do the PhD in. And it was hard for me to decide because I was so interested in many different fields, right? I was interested, it could have been engineering, it could have been physics, it could have been geography, it could have been music, it could have been so many things. And as a statistician, basically, you just get to work on everybody else's problems. It has so many applications, and that's the reason why I chose it. I think there is a famous quote by John Tukey who says that the best part of being a statistician is that you get to play in everybody's backyard. And so following on that line, still I've tried to focus my research more or less. So the main areas are image analysis being one main area. Image analysis meaning the process of taking images and making sense out of them, extracting information out of them, making inferences about them. And not the natural images that engineers typically look like, which would be the images that you take with a regular camera, but images that come from out of scientific research. For example, biomedical imaging, brain imaging, cancer imaging, and then also satellite images. And I also see other types of images like, let me rephrase this, other types of data like climate output models or even astronomical measurements.
I'm always fascinated by all these images.
All these, they're also images in a different way, but they all come from scientific context.
Yes.
Right? And so that's an area where an impact can be made. And so my research more or less focuses on analysis of all those types of areas. And it's very interesting that the similar statistical techniques will apply to all these types of data, even though they come from very different sources.
I had some experience with the NASA images, okay, over Siberia where there were all these lights. Turned out to be oil wells that were burning, 2,000 or 3,000 of them, too, and all over the world.
Wow.
And that led into a research project. But that's a case where there was no statistics needed. Everybody knew that they were oil wells, and so there are some cases where the question, the science question is open, and other cases it's not.
Right. A colleague of mine in the psychology department at Stanford, when I did my PhD.
I thought you said Caltech.
Caltech was a master's.
Okay.
Yes.
And Stanford was a PhD?
Yes. So my PhD thesis was applied to brain image analysis. And a colleague of mine in the psychology department, who I work with, he told me from the beginning, he said, you graph things, and if you can see the results, then they're there. And the only reason why you need statistics is if you cannot see them. And to some extent, that is true. When measurements are well made and the results are clear, then statistics are still useful in order to quantify the uncertainty. If there is, I can imagine in that situation that you're describing, that there may have been some uncertainty in the location of those wells, perhaps, or not. I don't know. So they may still be useful. But there's many, many situations where the data is not clear, right? You really need to look deeper.
Okay, let's just take a short break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli, and our guest today is Armin Schwartzman, and he's from the Department of Biostatistics at the University of California in beautiful, sunny San Diego. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, and Armin Schwartzman from the Department of Biostatistics at the University of California in San Diego. So you were telling us, Armin, that, you know, you were having a successful career in high tech, but you were sitting at a screen doing very sophisticated high tech work, but you felt that nobody outside your office or your laboratory knew anything about this. And in the end, it was just to make people be able to watch football more comfortably on television. So you moved into something which you thought was much more satisfying for your own endeavor, that you're going to make a difference in some areas, and you've chosen biomedical aspects like imaging, and you've chosen also to study the climate and climate variations. Let's talk a little bit about that second, because it's such a big topic these days, and most people out there listening to the program will hear that, oh, well, we've modeled this, that, and the other, and if we carry on doing what we're doing today, by 2020 or 2030 or 2050, we don't know, I don't remember the data, that, you know, the temperature is going to rise so much that Florida will be flooded or something like that. Are you into that type of statistical analysis, and can you talk to us, how do you go about doing that sort of modeling?
So I have not performed the modeling myself.
No, right.
The models are collections of differential equations and very complicated dynamical systems that run in big clusters. Some of the data that I've looked at comes from NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. But I have looked at the outputs from those computer models. And it's been interesting to see that there are many choices that go into the simulation of these models, not only from that institution, but other institutions around the world. They may have other models, and I'm still trying to understand why they are so different, possibly simply because maybe some labs know how to model particular natural systems, while maybe others don't, or maybe they don't have the capacity. A lot has to do with personnel, to whether you actually have a postdoc available in the lab who knows how to model that piece. And sometimes it's like this. But the interesting part is that all these different models have different outputs, and they don't agree. And so I'm looking at this problem from an objective point of view and say, well, I really want to know what's happening. So what I've tried to do is to compare these models, and also if there's a projection, for example, in a temperature rise between the 20th century and 21st century, then assess how much of what we see in that increase could be due to natural variability. By natural variability, I mean by variation that you would see from year to year. Some summers are hotter than others. So I've done that just from a pure statistical point of view. So from the data that I see, at least I can assess how much variability I observe naturally, and then use that as my reference to see how much warning these models are predicting and determine how much we can really believe.
When you look at the data, how many years does it go over? The reason I'm asking that is there's data about dust storms where the gentleman who works here actually went back to the Roman Empire because he was taking data out of the literature saying there is a drought here, there's a drought there, and there's a straight line between droughts and these huge dust storms. So to me, one of the questions about climate change or anything else is, you know, how much data over how many years can you actually say something about?
Climate model simulations are shorter in range. The ones that I've looked at from NCAR span about 30 years in the 20th century and 30 years in the 21st century. So that is, of course, not a long enough time to consider all the possible sources of variation. There are climate records that go back to the end of the 19th century, and the rest is proxies, right, that also go back into many thousands of years. It is well known that there's been a lot of variability in the climate in recorded history. As you mentioned, the Roman period, there is a little ice age from the Middle Ages, and all that is true. I have not looked at the data, to be honest, but what I'm basing my assessments on is on these simulations. And the simulations, what they do is that they try to incorporate as much as we know about the physical mechanisms that control climate and environment, including the sun and the atmosphere and the oceans and their interactions and everything else. And they add to that a particular input, a lever that goes into this dynamical system, which is greenhouse gases that we pumped into the atmosphere. And that can be controlled. The simulations have been done in such a way that if no CO2 is put into the atmosphere, then the prediction of what the temperature would look like, both compared to the observed record and the future, the simulations match more or less the observed record, but then they continue more or less within the same range into the future. And once we put in all the CO2 or the greenhouse gases into the equation, then that rises up the temperature. But that's because there's a physical principle, which is the greenhouse effect.
So would you say it's an open question? Because a lot of people disagree, and a lot of scientists say it's an open question about putting the CO2 in, about the CO2 versus the natural changes.
For me, seeing that graph about how simulating with and without the greenhouse gases makes such a big difference, I found that very convincing, because putting in that extra CO2 into the model really drives up the temperatures in the ways that we are observing, while not doing that does not. But yes, it is an open question in the sense that the uncertainty still needs to be quantified. There's still a lot of disagreement between models. And so there is really uncertainty. On the other hand, maybe another way to look at this is to think about environmental impact of other forms. Not only climate is a complicated system, and I think it's hard for people to understand because it is so global. But there's no denying, and now I'm speaking out of my personal opinion, that society as we know it is having an environmental impact in other ways that are much easier to measure. For example, we're creating dead zones in oceans, right, and killing fish and killing species and many other things that are much easier to assess. And so considering that society is having such a big impact in so many areas of environment, it's certainly possible that we could have an impact on our
atmosphere. So the bottom line to that is the population is going to double in a few years, and we're going to make a big impact.
Yes, but one must keep in mind that all these projections to the future are extrapolations, and all that is based on what we know now and given the conditions now. And as time goes on, the world is going to change, probably because of technology, maybe because people will change their behavior. We don't know.
We'd like to ask you how statistics apply to disease outbreaks throughout the country or throughout the world. All of a sudden, there's one here and none there. And
Well, Russell is going to get onto, you know, the statistical analysis and, you know, the idea that we have vaccines and they're not 100% effective. But every now and again you hear of an outbreak of some disease mm-hmm. that seems to be clustered around a particular geographic area. And people go to that area and think, my God, what is it that's here? And of course, as I understand it, and I don't understand it, as I have heard, that when you think about statistical analysis, getting cluster outbreaks is part of the statistical distribution.
Sure. I must start by clarifying that the goal of statistics is descriptive, first of all. It is to describe the distributions and describe the world as we understand it.
Not necessarily the reasons why these things happen.
Well, yes. We also try to understand causality. That is much harder to assess, though. And that is a very active area of research in epidemiology called causal inference. Some of my colleagues work on this, trying to establish whether it's possible to infer causality in observational studies, which is pretty difficult to do. But anyhow, the reason why these outbreaks happen, as far as I understand it, is because there is mutation in viruses. And at least the statistics has been very useful in describing how fast these mutations happen. And then once these mutations occur, and then they can spread because the immune systems of populations are not ready to fight these new types of viruses. The same thing happens with resistance to bacteria, et cetera.
That's a good point. And therefore, you could get clusters because in that region, transmission is giving you the problem. But go back to sort of diseases. I remember once, I don't know what the particular disease is, but it's something to do with the brain. And there was outbreaks. And there was one here in El Paso. And they were saying, oh, well, it must be something to do with the lead in the water or the lead that's coming from the smelter. And, of course, there was no proof for this whatsoever. And I remember statisticians saying, oh, well, don't worry. When you look at, you know, disease overall or outbreaks will occur. And it's got nothing to do with what you just said, a specific strain of a particular bacterium or whatever, but it's just the way statistics are, that you will always get outbreaks. Clusters, I think, is the expression that I used. Is that, am I wrong? Because that's what I remember being told.
You are right. I was not thinking about it that way, but yes, there are distributions. And distributions have means and have variances and they have tails. And they're extreme events that always have a certain probability of happening. And in this case, I can imagine a mechanism where even with no mutations of any kind, there will be individuals who will not have the immune system exactly right for fighting those diseases. And so diseases will appear and will infect individuals and they will get transmitted. And so outbreaks will occur simply because these events do happen with certain problems.
We just got a few minutes left in the program. I want to hear from you how you look back on your decision-making processes, all right? That is that you left this highly paid and very high-tech career that you were looking for when you were 19,
yes.
All right? And now you've moved into something where there's much more direct applicability to the world, to people's well-being. Not that sitting in front watching a football match isn't helping in the well-being of a lot of people. Are you happy with that decision? Do you see where the future is going to be for you? Because you're a relatively young scholar, you know. Do you see that this was a great decision and now I've got a good direction that I'm going to stick with?
Of course, I would not change anything. I've learned so much along the way. And I hope to continue to expand my research and expand the areas in which I can and where I can make an impact and influence.
And you work as a team. You have graduate students, undergraduates working with you in doing this analysis. Or are you mainly a one-man band that goes around to different people's gardens, as you put it?
No, I cannot do this alone. Of course not. I do have graduate students and postdocs work with me, but I have lots of collaborators. Locally in the United States, around the world, in Israel and in Europe, in South America. Scientists is a collective endeavor, and all my papers have multiple authors.
Okay, right. And do you get the asterisk?
I used to be the first author earlier on. Now I tend to be more of the senior author.
The senior author. Well, it's been a lot of fun talking to you. I'm not quite sure we got to the nub of some of the things that we could have got to if we had more time. But we only have 29 minutes to record this in. Because this whole business of, and Russ is the one here, is so critical of the climate change people who are always blaming CO2. But, you know, as you pointed out, if you take CO2 out, all the predictions tell you something. And when you include the CO2, they come much more in line with the actuality. And that's pretty compelling.
Yeah, and I have a group that supports me, and they're called Trees and Plants. They need the CO2, and they love it.
Well, that's excellent. I am a big believer that any change that we make to the industry and how we do things is only going to happen if we can see immediate benefits as well.
Well, there's an immediate benefit by listening to Science Studio. You can agree, you can disagree, you can understand, or you don't understand, but you'll realize that science is being done by real people with real passions. And so, Armin Schwartzman, thank you so much for being here today on Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith and Russ, both of you.
Yes, thank you very much, and thanks to Kimberly Garcia, our producer.
And we will be back next week with another stimulating program, so don't go too far from the radio. Bye-bye.